Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Donna Poniatowski-Sims about her book, Donna's Bar and Grill, New Orleans. Is a place where we love our music venues, and my guest today, Donna Poniatowski, has some great stories to tell in Donna's Bar and Grill, New Orleans. Her book about the place she and her husband, Charlie Sims, ran from 1993 to 2010. Her new book is a biography of an institution, a kind of family scrapbook, and a chronicle of the brass band music our city is known for. Donna, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Susan. I'm so glad to be here.
So much action took place at that corner of Rampart and St. Anne, I mean, where Donna's was located. And as you write, you had 1 foot in the quarter, 1 foot in Treme. So tell us how you and Charlie Sims got together and how Donna's came to be.
Well, I was actually riding my Harley through town. And
you stopped for a Bloody Mary breakfast, I believe.
Did. And I ran into this friend actually of my first husband's who had passed. My husband had passed at that point in time. And he was talking about getting a place on the corner of Rampart and St. Anne. Well, I thought to myself, I'm not quite sure about that, but let me think about it. So I continued on my journey, and on the way back, I decided I would do it. I was kind of at a crossroads because my husband, John Poniatowski, had passed. Had a good job teaching, and I really love teaching. That's kind of my passion, too. But I just wanted to come back home.
New Orleans is really home for you?
Absolutely. So my first husband and I had a music club, and so I told my partner-to-be, Tom Hill, I said, well, I would like to do music in it. Well, you know, it's Rampart Street, blah, blah, blah. And so we started out without the music. I then went down and said, well, look, we need some music in here. We couldn't really afford the people that I had played in my first place, which was on Bourbon Street,
7-Eleven, yeah.
With my first husband. And that was a traditional people. We were into Preservation Hall and, you know, doing all of the second lines. Back then, nobody hardly knew about the second lines. We had an inn at Buster Holmes's restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where you actually heard about it. There were no route sheets. So. Mm-hmm. Sylvester finally did that. Sylvester was a door person at Donna's.
I know. I noticed that name. It popped right out at me.
Sylvester Francis, who has Backstreet. He started Backstreet Cultural Museum. So I decided to go in business with Tom Hill, and he had another little place over on Arlene's and Bourbon. And I told him at first, I said, I don't want anything to do with cooking. I said, I've cooked enough in my life. I don't want to cook anything else. I just want a music club.
So didn't you have two Charlies who were going to take care of the cooking?
I did. So I met my first Charlie. Tom Hill introduced him to me in Johnny White Sports Bar, which is what he owned part of. So then Charlie, my Charlie, said, well, there's another Charlie. We both are looking for a place to have a little kitchen, and while one of us is on the road with Amtrak, the other one can be in the place. So we'll just swap out as chefs.
Now that's your Charlie who was on the road with Amtrak.
And so was the other Charlie.
Oh, they both were?
So what they were going to do is continue with Amtrak, but also run a business, lease the kitchen from Tom and me. That lasted 3 days.
Two Charlies were down to one.
It was down to one. And Charlie Sims sat there on one of the pickle buckets and said, I know that you can cook. He said, if you want to try this, I'll stay on. I said, well, it seems that we have to have some sort of kitchen with this bar. So, okay, we'll do it. So that's how I came to start hanging out with Charlie, because I took Charlie to around to like Dookie Chase's and some other places to get a feel for the real New Orleans stuff, the food here. But he had already had some introduction to it because his first in-laws were from Donaldsonville.
Oh, well.
But he didn't quite know.
The Charlie burger, though.
Right.
And Charlie ribs.
That's right. And the ribs and the rib tips are a whole nother story, too.
That's the only thing I miss in this book. Where are those recipes?
Well, it seems that Charlie was actually going to write a cookbook before he became ill. And I do have part of it kind of there.
Think about it.
I am going to think about it. But I got started off on this just as a brass band thing, really.
Right.
And so then it kind of turned into this, it morphed into this whole thing.
Now, in your history of the brass band music, you go all the way back to the Fairview Baptist Church band and how many young musicians came out of that. So you pay homage to that institution.
I absolutely do, because we had had brass bands here since the Civil War, since the end of the Civil War. And some really great brass bands and generational musicians from those people who had the brass bands are in the book. Dr. Michael White, for example, and Richard Moten. Nobody really knows that they're cousins, I don't think. But they are. They go back. They're generational musicians.
So much of it is a family affair in this book.
And that's the whole thing that I'm trying to convey here about New Orleans music and why it's different. Our music is different, first of all, because it still has that African 2-4 beat, whereas most of our cities have the European 1-3 beat. So that 2-4 really allows you to get into what our culture is about, like the jazz processions that have the music, the brass bands, like the second lines, the social and pleasure clubs that have the music, and just everything, the conventions that used to come to town. I always wanted a
brass band.
Yeah. I mean, they were like the logo for the city, you know? So my whole efforts in doing this was to actually show people not the talents and the giftedness of these musicians, because I saw that. I attended my own bar for the most part.
Yeah.
As a result, I was able to talk to these people and learn what they were all about, and the fact that they played different genres of music. They might be in a brass band, but they might be playing Zydeco somewhere up in South Louisiana, you know, around. Or they might be playing with straight ahead guys. Roger Lewis is a really good example of that. Mm-hmm. Roger actually played with the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, came up into my place with Treme Brass Band, and just was all over the place. But he also played with people like Etta James. He played with all kinds of people. So I just wanted to point out, before the history was lost in that particular period, from about 90 up to, 93 really started it back, because the brass bands had kind of gone south for a second, you know? And Leroy, for example, who was at the Fairview, Leroy Jones, who plays the trumpet, he started his quintet, and some of the other guys started playing modern jazz. It still has a traditional jazz songs in it, a little more swing.
Yeah.
And then Leroy and them would do different arrangements of different songs and write their own songs. Like, he wrote the song Parlor for the Crawlers for the Night Crawlers. So there's so much talent here. And Harry Connick Jr. was one of our, I remember seeing him when he was 9 years old, playing out at Jazz Fest with Bob French, mm-hmm. who played at my place. And then later on in life, Harry Connick was doing one of his pro bonos out of Angola, and he came through New Orleans and came into our place with his band, and we were still open in the afternoons, and he had on this T-shirt that said, Three Hots and a Cot.
Uh-huh.
He was just so wonderful, and everybody was so happy to see him, and then he just sat down at our old piano and started playing, and he played for about an hour.
That's because you had such a welcoming atmosphere.
Well, I tried to have.
Yeah. So you also have a really funny story about a young trombone shorty.
Oh, indeed. Trombone shorty had a few stories there. I remember I would see him coming down the street, and everybody thinks Trombone Shorty always played the trombone or the trumpet, but he plays everything. And I'd see him coming down the street with that tuba, the sousaphone wrapped around him. The sousaphone was way bigger than he was. But anyway, they would stop in at my place on their way over to Treme, and I'd always give them something cold to drink, you know, and give them a little rest there. So they got to know me fairly well, and I was doing brass band blowouts on Sundays. And so Shorty comes up to me and he goes, "You know, Miss Donna, I think it's time we had a gig here."
Yeah.
And I went, "Oh, yeah? Well, it might be time, Shorty. What are you thinking of?" He says, I think my band, we should play for your brass band blowouts." And I go, "Well, okay, let's sit down and talk about it. You're the leader, right?" "Yes. Yes, ma'am, I'm the leader." And he was always so quiet, soft-spoken, and still is. But anyway, so we sat there, and it was just, and at first I said, "Well, you know, I have to pay you." And I said, "Secondly, you have to only play about 30 minutes, 20 minutes maybe, because you're still in school, and we're going to have you early on a Sunday, and we just want to get you in there so that you can kind of be part of the whole thing." He goes, "Okay." So he gave me this price, and it was hilarious. I said, "Okay. One thing you have to learn to do is negotiate with the managers and the people who own the places." And I said, "If you're only going to play for 20 minutes, you can't ask for a two-hour pay gig." So so we start, and by the time we finished, it was just so cute. I said, "And you get $15 extra because you're the leader." I said, "Always remember that. You get paid a little extra because you have to put everything together." And so they came up into my place, and they played it in my brass band blowout. He was off and running after that.
But they had to play early because they were still in school.
Oh, yeah.
I love that. Yeah.
All right, all right, all right.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Donna Poniatowski-Sims. She's talking about her new book, Donna's Bar and Grill New Orleans. Another person you pay a lot of tribute to is Doc Pollen, because he had so many bands going at once.
Doc Pollen was an icon. You know, Doc Pollen was just an exceptional businessman, to tell you the truth, as well as a musician. And that's kind of rare, I can't find out. But yeah, Doc Pollen came up to New Orleans. He walked the levee in New Orleans, and came in here and started playing and got married and had enough boys that he made his own brass band. But I was so thrilled to have him in my place, Doc Pollen. He did his 90th birthday party.
Wow.
He played the trumpet, and you would not believe the sound this man had at that age. Right. So I've got some really good stories in there about his kids, though, because he would not put up with nonsense.
Well, that's what you keep looking for in this book. It's so wonderful. Are those family ties with Mardi Gras Indians, with the brass bands. And Donna's was a family-friendly place.
I'm big on family. I come from a fairly large family. It's only my sister and me, but we grew up with my grandma and grandpa. I was born down here, but I started school a little north of Alexandria in central Louisiana. But we just had this huge extended family, and we had these big Sunday dinners. And when I came down here to New Orleans, right away, by the way, almost when I graduated, I stayed long enough to get a degree, and that was it. It just resonated with me. Everything resonated with me. The music. My grandpa could play. He never had a lesson in life, but he sang as well. And he actually sang in a quartet. We would go down the dusty road to where the Arnolds lived, and they just had this big old room, and everybody would just sit in and play. My Uncle R.C. used to play the guitar and sing, and people would dance, and I can remember going to sleep under the bench, but I'd be so excited, and then when they wake me up to go home, I wouldn't want to go home. I wanted to hear more music. But being out in the country like that, it was difficult for us to hear variety. So my sister and I, who plays the piano, actually won a scholarship for that, and but decided to get married and play for church instead. And I was the one that came to New Orleans and started hanging out with all the musicians and listening.
Everybody needs a family member in New Orleans.
Oh, I'm telling you, they do.
But once you got Donna's Open, it's like the whole music community became your family as well.
That's right. And that was why I was saying that is I didn't want a bar. I wanted a music club. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to sell drinks to if you're not a nonprofit, you have to make a living at it, which was kind of iffy, but nevertheless. But that's the way Charlie and I both felt. And that's the way we treated people. And we treated our clientele that way.
You also give people a background look at what it's like to run a French Quarter club.
Right, exactly.
You know, and it's not all sunshine.
It's really hard work. It was interesting to do it, and I'm glad we did it. And I'm glad we did it the way we did. And it was never really, you know, you're in business to make money, but it was never really about the money. Mm-hmm. I wanted the brass bands in there because at that point in time, they weren't playing those venues. I mean, you had Olympia, Preservation Hall, and whatever. And I think Maple Leaf and I kind of had Rebirth in there around the same time. Maybe they were a year ahead of me, I'm not sure. But to have all the brass bands together in one spot was unheard of.
Mm-hmm. You were the brass band headquarters, for sure.
That's right. That's what I wanted. And then because of having the brass bands in there, and like Leroy Jones had the Hurricane Brass Band, so everybody kind of had started in that kind of music and then went into something else, or some of them had started at Preservation Hall and doing the traditional thing like Wendell Brunius, for example, the trumpeter Wendell, and his another generational music, Bob French, another generational musician. And I do have in the book that, you know, Papa French was just one of the icons, too, of the New Orleans-style music. So all of those things just started to come together and blend together. So I started playing the modern jazz, Leroy, our modern jazz. I made a distinction in this book about modern jazz when it comes to New Orleans and other places.
You did indeed.
Because it is different. It's not the same. We still include our traditional songs or things like When My Dreamboat Comes Home and all that kind of stuff, you know, as well as other pieces. But then the Mardi Gras Indians started getting together at that time. That was kind of unheard of before the 90s. Mm-hmm. Every gang had its own turf and whatever. But then some of the folks started seeing how the brass bands were also getting out there. And I was talking to them about their suits and, you know, wow, this is quite an event.
And their practices.
And their practices. Their practices go on to this day. And mm-hmm. I just went to one not too long ago. At any rate, they asked me if they could play in there as a group from uptown, downtown, and all around town, as Craig Klein says. And they call themselves the Indians of the Nation.
Right.
And that's how they got started up in Donna's.
I have to say, the police make minor appearances in this.
They do, both good and
excitement.
Not so good.
Yeah.
First of all, I would like to preface by saying I really love our police. They are the best police I've ever seen at crowd control. They just go along with stuff to a point. You know, they always wear smiles. I've got this beautiful picture of two of them up on St. Charles. So we had a little problem there for a while when the police were actually not arresting, but stopping and searching the musicians. And it seems there was some dope dealing going on and they thought it was us. It wasn't, and not at all, because number one, I wouldn't have that kind of situation going on. I had one musician one time tell me, stop talking to me. You're using that teacher voice on me. I said, well, you're getting loaded, and it's not becoming, and you have to play, so don't.
Well, and the whole time you were writing this book, you were working on your doctorate. I mean, while you were at Donna's, you were working on your doctorate.
Yeah, my husband said I was one of the most overqualified bartenders he'd ever met. But I enjoyed meeting the people.
So putting this together, this is like a who's who in brass band music. It is so much fun to read. You look at these stories and think about these people, and it sends you out to listen to the music, which is what you want. So what was it like to really reckon with Donna's legacy as a place?
Well, you know, when we were doing it, it wasn't.
Had to put your head down and keep on going.
I just, you know, I thought breast pins were, was a good idea. I thought the straight ahead came into Donna's, you know. Uh-huh. That was Charlie. Charlie was from Chicago, and he missed it. And, you know, for a long time, New Orleans was not about straight ahead at all. I mean, you had Kid Jordan, and you had other people, Ellis, and, yeah, of course, the Bettys, all were doing the straight ahead stuff. But it wasn't, like, entrenched, like the New Orleans-style music. And a lot of the young kids who were coming in from NOCA and whatever, of course, thought that Wynton Marsalis was their hero, which he was. And at that time, Wynton had gotten those two Grammys. One of them was for the straight-ahead music with jazz, and one was classical. And so he, in effect, started telling them it was okay to play straight-ahead in New Orleans. And so I said, okay, I tell you what, and I always loved the Round Midnight thing. Uh-huh. Dexter Gordon, all those people. And I said, let's do a session for straight ahead and see how it goes. And it actually caught on. So it was just a series of firsts, the brass bands, the Mardi Gras Indians, the straight ahead as a regular gig. I never thought about it. Charlie never thought about it. I don't think anybody else ever did either, that we were actually breaking ground there, but we were. And it wasn't only until after we actually had to close on us that we realized that people actually missed us.
Oh.
So, yeah, and then when I tried to open it back up, of course, the city wouldn't give me a music license. They said, we have a moratorium on Rampart Street, and you can't have music there. I said, I never bothered anybody.
But the Funky Butt used to be on Rampart Street.
Yeah, we had a little thing going there for a while. Mm-hmm. Funky Butt was down in a block or two down, and then me, and then even some of the gay bars. And I remember the one next to us, one house over, they never played big music, but they'd have a guitar player playing jazz, or they'd invite maybe a duo in or something like that, because it was a fun street where you could walk up and down and listen to the music, and it gave a lot of people a place to go that wasn't necessarily right in the middle of the quarter.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Donna Poniatowski-Sims. She's talking about her new book, Donna's Bar and Grill New Orleans. The pictures in this book tell so much of the story, don't they?
Yes. I had a camera, and I would run out from behind the bar and take these pictures that I thought might be worthy of something to give to the musicians. Actually, there's over 400 in that book.
I know. It's amazing.
I kind of regret that I didn't maybe blow some of the others up a little bit more. But I chose the photos to go with the narrative. So when you see a photo on a page, it is actually telling you something in addition to the narrative. You know, they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. Well, if I'm going to talk to you about jazz funerals, there they are.
Right.
If I'm going to talk to you about our cultural traditions like social and pleasure clubs, there they are. If I'm going to talk to you about Donna's Bar and Grill and what happened up in there, there's the people who validate what I'm saying. Because if I say Wynton Marsalis played in there, and it's a little hole in a wall on Rampart Street, some people might not believe me.
And
but photos don't lie.
And there's a picture of you and Charlie in the top left hand.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Cover.
Yes. Yeah, my friend Margaret Steinman took that picture.
Well, it's a treasure. And that tells a big, big part of the story.
Right. The cook and the bartender dancing together, yes.
That's right. A fine romance.
It was, indeed.
We've been talking with Donna Poniatowski-Sims, whose new book is Donna's Bar and Grill, New Orleans. You can meet her Friday, December 12th at Chickiwawa on Canal Street, or Saturday, December 13th from 4 to 7 at Dauphine Street Books, 818 Charters. Donna, thank you so much.
And thank you, Susan. It was a pleasure to meet you.
You too. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Donna Poniatowski-Sims signs Donna's Bar & Grill New Orleans, Friday, December 12th at 8 at Chickiwawa, 2828 Canal Street, during the Leroy Jones Quintet Holiday Special. Donna also appears Saturday, December 13th from 4 to 7 at Dauphine Street Books, 818 Charters. The Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans holds a Christmas party Saturday, December 13th from 2 to 4. That's at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. Wayne Strohmeyer discusses and signs the new edition of Early Camellias in Louisiana, 1825 to 1860, Long Lost Treasures Rediscovered, Saturday, December 13th from 11 to 5 at Octavia Books. Megan Holt presents a talk honoring Jane Austen on her 250th birthday, Tuesday, December 16th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Six local authors will discuss their books Wednesday, December 17th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The authors in their books are Kathy Chipetta Spies, The Faith of New Orleans, Kathy Crichton, author of How Lonely Is the City, John Chartier, author of The Fallen Guardian, Elise Arden, author of The Gates of Guinea, that's book 4 in the Casket Girl series, Gillian Zane, author of SHTF, NOLA Zombie series, and D.M. Bourgeois, author of Edge of Reality. Errol Barron signs The Architecture of Painting, Thursday, December 18th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Dick Harpootlian signs Dig Me a Grave, Friday, December 19th at 5 at Garden District Bookshop.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.